This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our largest planetary neighbor, Jupiter, has always, well, it's always been an object of fascination, right? Just Google Galileo. For him, it was the moons. Later, we all wondered, what's going on under those bands of swirling clouds? And what's the deal with that big red spot? Anyhow, what's going on there? Well, this week, scientists published 46 separate scientific reports on different aspects of Jupiter, the first science results from the Juno mission. And they found a lot more questions. We always like that. Joining me now to sum up some of the Jovian surprises, as well as give a preview of what still lies ahead in store for the Juno mission, are my guests, Juno program scientist Jared Espley, based at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Juno Radiation Monitoring Investigation Lead Heidi Becker of NASA's JPL Laboratory. Welcome both to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Jared, what's the biggest surprise you've gotten so far?
Well, like you said, Ira, we're trying to understand what's going on inside of Jupiter, trying to understand what's beneath those beautiful clouds that we've all seen. And so as we're trying to probe the interior of the planet, we're really starting to get some surprises about what's going on the inside. Interesting surprises about how the magnetic field is produced, interesting surprises about how the core is distributed on the inside of the planet, and how the different atmospheric parts, different atmospheric components, constituents are distributed inside the planet.
Mm-hmm. But the outside, I mean, the atmosphere has certainly been surprising. We've seen pictures of huge cyclones at the poles.
Yeah, those things are awesome. So we've got both the cyclones at both of the poles. These are unexpected. We've got these really powerful bands and belts that we're all familiar with, but we see these cyclones that don't really look anything like what we see at the equator. And they, like you said, they're circling around, swirling around the northern pole. They're interesting scientifically, and they're just awesome from an artistic, aesthetic point of view as well.
What are they made out of?
Well, so the primary atmospheric constituents of Jupiter are hydrogen and helium, so they're also predominantly made out of those. But exactly how they're, the different components are still being analyzed.
Wow. Heidi, going into this, one of the big concerns was all the radiation around Jupiter and whether it would literally fry the instruments. How's it doing so far?
Well, actually, Juno's doing amazingly well. And that was the real nail biter for us because we're going someplace that nobody's ever flown before. So we didn't really know what would happen the first time we flew close to the planet. And it actually turns out that really close to the planet, it's a lot less than we were anticipating it would be, which is really great news. It's actually 10 times less than we modeled it to be very close to the planet. So Juno's doing just great.
That's another surprising thing. About the radiation so close to the planet being less than you thought, but Juno was really armored well for any sort of circumstance it might encounter.
That's exactly right. It's basically an armored tank, and when you fly someplace where things could be really nasty, you don't want to take any chances. So we've got a 400-pound metal vault that all of our electronics are in, and you just don't want to take any chances with that. So the armor's working, and there are other places further from the planet that are going to be pretty nasty, so we're going to need that suit of armor.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, at the press conference yesterday, one of the things you shared with us was a picture taken from within Jupiter's rings. Now, a lot of people don't realize Jupiter has rings.
Yes.
But it's always gripping to see the night sky from another world. You could see Orion from Jupiter.
Yes, it's amazing how similar the heavens look from another planet as they do on Earth. It's basically what we're used to when we're looking up in the night sky. And that's how we navigate. We count on that. We have cameras that take pictures of the stars and basically connect the dots and figure out which way we're pointing. So that's how the engineering works, but it's beautiful to see it in a picture.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jared, describe a little bit of the orbit that Juno is taking. It's really very elliptical, right? It goes way out and comes back in and dives in for a few hours and takes some about 2 or 3 hours of data and goes back out again?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a 53-day orbit, as you said, which makes it very elliptical and means that when we come screaming in, it's super close to the planet. It lasts just a few hours. And then we go way out far into the space around Jupiter, what we call the magnetosphere. and make interesting observations with the charged particles, the plasmas out there, and then come back in again every 53 days and start building up this network, this web of observations, because every time we come in, Jupiter is rotated slightly as our spacecraft has come in a different time, so we see a different part of the planet.
Mm-hmm. And those bands we were talking about a little bit while ago, it's interesting that how deep do the bands go? Do we know that? Will we know more once we get more information back from the spacecraft?
Yeah, like I said, that's actually one of the main science goals of Juno, is to try and understand the interior beyond that superficial layer. And so, in fact, one of the really interesting results that we've already gotten is that there is a equatorial band that goes very, very deep. There's ammonia that goes very deep into the atmosphere. But in other regions, it seems to not be banded in the deep atmosphere like it is on the surface. And so why that is frankly still a mystery. And of course, that's what we want as scientists, is mysteries to try and understand.
I know besides the bands, when I look at my backyard telescope at Jupiter, you see the bands, you see the moons, and then you get to see a little bit of the red eye on Jupiter. Are you going to get close to that thing to take some good, you know, homemade pictures there?
Yeah, that's right. We'll make our homemade pictures for all of humanity with our spacecraft. It's the great red spot, like you're talking about. This that great, huge storm that's lasted for hundreds of years. And in fact, on our very next close pass, we're going to fly more or less directly over that. And so we're really looking forward to getting good observations, both superficially with our camera, but also especially with our instruments that can look inside of the planet and try and get an understanding of what's going inside.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, what's the time frame for the rest of the mission? It's going to keep doing its loops, and then what happens?
It keeps doing its loops, and then we have to get rid of Juno. Eventually, we're going to have to make sure that we don't smash into some other body in that system and contaminate it. We're not a perfectly clean spacecraft. We brought a little bit of us along with it, so unfortunately, we'll have to say goodbye at some point. But looks like Juno's going to last a long time.
Mm-hmm. Now, how far in can you till its last X number of minutes, can you keep collecting data?
Well, that'll depend on what's still alive and able to talk back to us. I think we'll keep listening as long as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Jared, any ideas about that?
Yeah, I mean, Heidi's right. It's kind of not exactly knowable. The interesting thing, of course, is as we get deeper and deeper in the atmosphere, we'll be turned away from our robotic extension, our robot, our spacecraft, mm-hmm. will be turned away from us here at Earth. So we won't be able to directly get transmissions through our radio antenna as easily. So at the very last end, our extension will be by itself, mm-hmm. crashing in a glorious way into the atmosphere of Jupiter.
And let's talk a bit about the core. I mean, is Juno upsetting our ideas of what we think is at the center of the planet?
It is, absolutely, which is what we wanted to do. That's what you want to do in science, is explore new things, and we are. It turns out that Jupiter's core is definitely not the way we expected it to be. The magnetic field that comes from that interior is thought to be planet-wide, but it also looks like there's very small spatial scale features. So that means that there's something much closer to the surface that's contributing to the magnetic field. And frankly, that's a real mystery and really exciting to see that there might be multiple sources of the magnetic field.
You mean there could be another core? Or is that a couple of cores or other bodies in there or what?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't think it's cores plural per se. There probably is the main magnetic field that's being produced by the core, and then whether or not there's a secondary dynamo, a secondary source of magnetic field closer to the surface in a layer of conducting material, or whether or not that main core just has lots of small scale features that manifest themselves close to the surface, we frankly don't know yet. But we will soon, because that's why we're doing multiple orbits to create that web of observations, like I said, from different parts of the planet.
So can you actually construct like a 3D picture of what the core looks like?
That's literally what we're going to try and do. Yep.
Wow. I want to be in the room when that happens. I'm also fascinated by, Heidi, when you talked about the desire and the need to smash Juno into Jupiter because you don't want to contaminate any of the other moons.
That's right.
Because we may be sending spacecraft to those other moons, and you don't want bits of, contamination there.
That's right. So the rule is to not contaminate. So it means you have to say goodbye, unfortunately.
Because, you know, I think people think that the spacecraft are literally sterile when we send them up into space, but they're not.
Some of them are, but it's a very challenging thing to do, as you can imagine. It's a very intricate spacecraft, and every little piece has to be perfectly clean. So that's a hard thing to do. It's not something that Juno is able to do.
What's the last date we'll hear from Juno? What's our schedule here?
So we're expecting to see Juno continue for the next few years. We have a plan to have it keep funded for the next couple years, and then we also are hoping to be able to continue the science that we're doing into the future. The spacecraft's healthy, and we have no doubts that we'll continue to get good science.
And then, of course, later on, we have the demise of Cassini, too. I mean,
yep.
That'll be hard saying goodbye to that spacecraft.
Yeah, it's a neat thing because there are robotic extensions into the solar system. We humans have created these things. We took the ingredients that make up us and changed them into robots, and they're out there looking for those ingredients out in the cosmos. So it really does kind of give you an emotional connection to the cosmos as you're exploring.
Very poetic. Very poetic, Jared. Thank you. Thank you both for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Juno program scientist Jared Espley, based at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and Juno radiation monitoring investigation lead Heidi Becker at NASA's JPL out there in Pasadena. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about the usefulness of useless knowledge. Scientists have been defending basic research since Einstein's time. And we're going to we think it's a good time to revisit Abraham Flexner's classic 1939 essay, The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge. And we're going to have the head of the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton here with us to talk about Robert Digraph. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in 1939, Abraham Flexner wrote an essay with a whimsical title, The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge. And it was, though, a very serious defense of research driven by curiosity rather than practical concerns, of advancing knowledge for the sake of it rather than focusing first on how it will benefit us. We cherish the hope that the unobstructed pursuit of useless knowledge will prove to have consequences in the future as in the past, Flexner wrote. Flexner also happened to be the founding director of the Institute for Advanced Study, the mathematical institution that was Albert Einstein's research home when he came to the U.S. And today, the current director of the IAS wants to make the same assertion that basic research pays dividends scientists can't calculate when they first set out to explore the big, exciting questions of the universe. But if so, how do we prioritize finite funding? And how do we argue that the value of, say, a Higgs boson to the public or to politicians who hold the purse strings? How do we make those arguments? Well, hopefully Robert Digraph will help us. He's here. He's director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton and a mathematical physicist. And he's written a companion essay for the republication of Flexner's essay. It's out from Princeton University Press this year. He joins us from London. Welcome to Science Friday. Thanks for staying up late with us.
Glad to be with you, Ira.
Tell us first about the scene. What was the environment that inspired Flexner's essay? Why did he feel basic research needed justification?
Well, then I have to bring you back to the 1920s and the 1930s, when actually education and research in the United States, coming just out of the Depression, was really very, very practical focused. It didn't have kind of the research culture that, for instance, was at that time present in Europe. And Flexner was really critical of these universities. For instance, he's criticizing Columbia University that has courses in beekeeping and poultry raising. And he strongly feels, looking back into history, that the really momentous transformations in society, he mentions, for instance, radio, come from deep questions about reality and studying the laws of physics.
And so he actually created a place, the Institute for Advanced Study. He got some funding. It was interesting. We got from the, was it the Bamberger family?
The Bamberger
department
family
store people
sold.
In Jersey?
Exactly. They sold the department store 3 weeks before the Wall Street crash. And so they were one of the few who had cash in hands. And they came to Flexner. He convinced them to create such an institute. And then they said, well, Flexner, you have always been criticizing others. Now you should give others the opportunity to criticize you and actually lead the institution.
And so he started collecting some of the biggest names in big thinkers of the time, Einstein, other
people.
Well,
he was extremely lucky, so to say, that world history intervened and that certainly the greatest minds of Europe were chased away. They had to flee and came as refugees and immigrants to the United States. And he was very, very active. And so his institute became kind of an Ellis Island for scholars at risk. And so essentially the crème de la crème of German mathematics was certainly in Princeton, New Jersey.
Who else came over?
Well, John von Neumann, who would essentially build the first modern computer. Kurt Gödel, the logician, who often said is the, after Aristoteles, perhaps the best logician of the last 2,000 years. But also like art historians as Erwin Panofsky and later economists as Albert Hirschman. So there was a whole cast. And Flexner then writes in 39, he says, if we act with courage now, then historians in 50 years will look back and will say that this is the moment where the center of gravity of research crossed the Atlantic.
Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Taking time to think about big things and talk about the history of the Institute for Advanced Study and also talking about this essay he wrote. It's interesting. He must have thought a while about naming it. What he was going to name it before he called it.
Yeah, it's whimsical, of course, and useful knowledge. Of course, it was kind of a concept. You know, it really appeared in the tide of the Enlightenment in the late 18th century, because for some aspect that knowledge could be useful was a new thing. But he felt in some sense that we were overshooting and that he should bring back the kind of uselessness, and not in a frivolous way, but more in a deep curiosity-driven way.
Do you think we are at that point now in a certain way?
Well, in writing the introduction, I felt I had kind of mixed feelings. On the one hand, it's so easy to validate his point because the 78 years in between, we have seen tremendous applications of fundamental basic research. Think about everything that happened in the life sciences with the whole genetic and molecular basis. Think about computers. Think about nanomaterials. So it's easy. But then, in some sense, we are perhaps back again in the time of Flexner, that we see that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis put on practical use. And we just know that to really make breakthrough solutions and actually find the most useful applications, it's usually as a byproduct of curiosity-driven basic research. So I felt a little bit despondent that I have to kind of make the argument again as Flexner was doing in the late 30s.
Do you think it's penetrating at all this time? I mean, it obviously had some effect back then.
Well, I think actually these days it's important that we have these discussions. You know, if you for science, but also for society, if you're a politician, you ask, you know, are your children better off than you are? And I would say, as a scientist, if I look, so to say, at my children, so young scientists who are now doing their PhD, they're in a much worse situation than my generation, say 20, 30 years ago. The percentages of, you know, getting grants are less than half what they were in my time. And also, I think they have to justify their research in a much more detailed way, being evaluated, being measured. And so it's kind of stifling. And I think this is a bad thing. But also, I think, you know, for society, it's very important that we protect what I would say is really the engine that drives progress, which is the ability of human beings and somehow to see things that aren't there yet, visualize new applications, dream big, and ask difficult questions. And somehow there are individuals that are able to go out, venture far, and solve these questions.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you quoted, it was a great quote about there was a turning point where the U.S. now sort of became the center of gravity for science. It had moved from Europe over to the U.S. I'm trying to remember a few weeks ago after the French elections, a French president basically addressed American scientists, didn't he? And he said, look, if you're not going to be funded in America, come on over. What did you think of that?
Flexner actually makes the point also in his essay. He says, historians will tell you that these centers of gravity have migrated over the world. They never fixed. And I think in particular that the United States has been kind of lucky and or very wise in two things. One is a very generous funding for science, particularly after World War II, where the United States essentially created the modern research university, the things like the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, very generous basic funding. And second, being open to other ideas, people from other cultures and other countries. And I feel kind of tinkering with these two elements is almost doing kind of open heart surgery on the American economy and American society. And definitely there are other countries who are looking kind of envious at the magnetism that America still has. It attracts, I would say, a large share of the top talent of scientists and scholars in the world. But indeed, this could move, and I think it's a very precious thing that we should cherish.
Because we're seeing, with the rise of third world countries like China and India, and the amount of money they're investing in their education systems and their belief in science.
They try to copy the American model. They have seen this working. They also try to implement the science in the development of their countries. And so we have to be, in some sense, that there's a race between the various areas in the world is, of course, a good thing because you need competition. It will actually bring out the very best. But the United States is still in a very privileged position of, if you think of the leading institutions, the top 50 of universities, still a fair share of that is based in America.
Well, if scientists are feeling like they need to move and some of them don't want to move, what can they do in this country?
Well, it's interesting that in Flexner's time, too, there was also a discussion about Flexner, for instance, felt that scientists should kind of focus on the science. Well, Einstein, for instance, had a very different view. Even when he was on the boat coming to America, Flexner sends him a cable, keep a low profile, don't say anything. And when President Roosevelt invites Einstein to the White House, Flexner writes back, well, he's an important scientist, you have difficult calculations to do, cannot be bothered. Einstein is incredibly upset because he felt if the world was interacting with him, he should also interact with the world. So I think there's also this question for scientists, should you speak out? Should you kind of advocate? Should you kind of educate not only your fellow colleagues, but perhaps the public at large too?
Yeah, because Einstein certainly was no shrinking violet when it came to speaking out.
No, and it's remarkable being in Princeton and learning so much about him that I would say he shaped his equations with the same care as he shaped his sayings. You know, in fact, he would even, if he had these wonderful quotes of Einstein, when he had found one, he would type it and the secretary would cut it out and put it in a box. So I like to think that, 50 years before Twitter, Einstein was already tweeting.
I'm trying to think of, more... we had Rachel Carson talking about Silent Spring. We had Carl Sagan. We had these leaders. There aren't great vocals, political science leaders in the States anymore, like there were back in the States.
No, I think it's very important that we grow this up. And one thing I'm incredibly encouraged with, if you look at particularly the younger generation, they're kind of a very naturally multitasking. They love to do research, but they also like to talk about it, share it, find new ways of communicating. And I think, now, if you look back over the last 50 years, if you would say what are the two things that really impressed, I would say it's the rise of science, the incredible technology that has brought, but also the incredible increase in communication. There's so many ways to communicate, but communicating science is not like growing as fast as you might think. So I think we have to find new ways. And here I actually might differ with Flexner, who was in some sense thought of science as kind of a, he wanted to create a paradise, while others said, well, paradise is wonderful. As one of the trustees, Felix Frankfurter, said, paradise was fine for one person, but for more not. And people like Einstein, but others also felt that, you know, you should engage with the world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Robert Digraph, a mathematical physicist and director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, the famous place. We're talking about republication of the usefulness of useless knowledge, Abraham Flexner's wonderful essay back in 1939. And let's go to the phones. Let's go to Kitty in San Antonio. Hi, Kitty.
Good afternoon, Ira. Great show today. I'm just concerned about the fact that with the present administration that we have, that it's just denigrating science and alternative facts, that the children of today are aware that science truly matters and that science is something should be sought out after and proclaimed rather than kept under a bushel, you know, and let the light of science continue. And I'm interested in getting a copy of that publication that you're speaking about today, Flexner's.
We'll get it. Dr. Digraph, where can I get it?
You can buy it with online. It's in bookstores. It's published by Princeton University Press. It's a relatively small book on a big idea, and I totally agree with the fact that we should not only communicate the products of science and the wonderful things that it has brought, but also the values, careful analysis, you know, doing experimentation. You can actually, some certain things work, others do not. An intense discussion, always aware of the facts, but also about the uncertainties. And recently somebody asked me, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and there was one thing that everybody in the world would understand about science, what would you pick? And my answer was the scientific method. The fact that we have a systematic way to analyze reality, because reality has this kind of perky behavior of being right in the end. And so it's very difficult to fight reality. And we just devised over the last few hundred years this very systematic way of understanding it. And I think that's something that we should share. It's not only something for the few experts. It should be values that are important for society. And by the way, I also feel society and just anybody should be interested in what science is doing, because, you know, there are such tremendous transformations ahead with lots of things happening, whether it's artificial intelligence, the creation of artificial life. There are momentous decisions to be made. I think it's important that citizens are aware what's happening and are getting involved.
So you're more hopeful than pessimistic.
Well, in the end, I think it's one of the most wonderful things that we have seen, the rise of science. I'd like to point out that, you know, in the last 200, 250 years, human life expectancy has tripled. Just imagine what an incredible amount of misery has been kind of avoided. But of course, there are ups and downs. So the long-term trend will be good. But I think it's important that we realize that this is a critical stage. And I think, you know, some people feel that science is under siege, but also see kind of almost an immune response. I think many scientists and scientific organizations feel this is the moment to speak out. This is the moment to engage and actually shine a light on all the wonderful successes of science that we are actually using every day. You can point to anything in the room and you can ask, where did that come from? From a light bulb to a radio. And it's always traced back to some very curious individual that probably was just tinkering around.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Have a great
weekend. It's a great pleasure.
You're welcome. Robert,
thank you.
Dick Digraph is mathematical physicist and director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And we were talking about the Abraham Flexner essay, The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge, published way back in 1939. And it's still around and still relevant today. And you can get it at probably somewhere online. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk what do an astronaut and a professional football player have in common. Leland Melvin will tell us, because he has done both, and he's written all about it in his new book, Chasing Space. He joins us after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Most people have a couple of different jobs in their career. Well, before I was in radio, I flipped burgers, I sold men's clothing, I worked in a factory. But our next guest has really tried out all kinds of professions. He was drafted as a wide receiver in the NFL. From there, he went on to become a materials science engineer. Finally, he became an astronaut with two missions to the International Space Station. And now he's an author and an educator. So what do a football player and an astronaut have in common? And how do you get to do two of the dream jobs of thousands of kids? My next guest is here to tell us about his journey. Leland Melvin is a former NASA astronaut, author of the new book, Chasing Space, An Astronaut's Story of Grit, Grace, and Second Chances. He joins us here in our CUNY studio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be here, Ira.
Nice to have you here. I discovered in reading your book we have two things in common. I said before we have two things in common. One is we both almost burned down our mother's house. Tell us about what you did there.
You know, my mom gave me this age-inappropriate, non-OSHA certified chemistry set back in the day when you can have things that blow up, you know.
Right.
And I mixed these two chemicals together. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, I created this explosion. I burned her carpet. She ran in the room and, you know, I got a spanking, but my brain was activated to science because I was a scientist at that point. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I became a chemistry major in college because of that one experiential moment in my life.
Was your mother influential on any of that?
Yeah, I mean, she gave me cameras, and I set up a dark room in her basement.
Right.
And all these little experiential things to do outside of the classroom. And those were the things that really got me geeked about science.
I mentioned all the different things you've done, but one of the things you mentioned in your book is the chance for a second chance.
Yes.
In life. How important was that?
It's extremely important. I mean, I remember dropping this touchdown pass in the end zone at my homecoming game my senior year, and I went to the sideline waiting to be, you know, slammed down on the bench, and my coach said, "I believe in you. Go back out there and catch the ball." And so we ran the exact same play. And this time I'm in the end zone to catch the ball. The scout that was walking out of the stadium after I dropped the first pass turned around and saw him in the end zone doing a little dance. And he said, "Maybe this guy can play for us." And so that one catch resulted in a $180,000 scholarship to the University of Richmond. And I was ready to sit on the bench. I was embarrassed. My friends were there. And so we all have people that know better than we do that we can still, you know, perform after such a horrific failure.
So what put you on the road to becoming an astronaut?
Well, you know, it was all the preparation as a child, I think. You know, I watched Neil and Buzz walk on the moon in 69, and that wasn't something that I saw that I could do. I didn't see someone that looked like me. And it wasn't until, you know, going through science and working at NASA that a friend of mine said, "You'd be a great astronaut." I'm like, "Really, me?" He gave me the application. I didn't fill it out. That same year, another friend of mine filled it out. He got in. I said, "Well, if NASA can let people like that in, that knucklehead in, I can be one too." So I learned more about the program after he got in. He came back and flew back to NASA Langley with John Young.
Hmm.
And I gave a talk to John Young.
Legendary, John.
Legendary. I mean, he's flown every vehicle.
Right.
You know, walked on the moon.
Right.
Columbia, STS-1.
He was, yeah.
And so
he spanned them all.
Yeah, and so if John Young says, "Well, you should apply," maybe you should apply.
He used to fly before the shuttle was launched. He used to fly down the range to see if everything was clear.
Yeah.
Air Force Range.
A legend.
It was late. Let me start again. There's the idea that you're either a jock or a nerd, right?
Yeah.
There's this stereotype, but you seem to have melded both of them together.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking to someone the other day, and they said that jocks are usually connected with nerds when they're trying to get their homework done, right? Even though they don't want to admit it, they're kind of connected.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I had a school that was appreciative of me being able to be in calculus class and then going to football practice. And even at the University of Richmond, before I signed my letter of intent, I asked the coach, I said, "Can I get a, you know, chemistry degree here and play football?" And that means at a small school that I'm going to miss practice. And the two hard practices a week, I only practiced like for 15 minutes. So that chemistry lab. So they held up to their end of the bargain. But you can do both if you're giving the time, the access, and the opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to talk to us, 844-SciTalk. Also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI, talking with Leland Melvin, author of Chasing Space, An Astronaut's Story of Grit, Grace, and Second Chances. Now, my staff will be very angry with me if I don't ask you this next question. That's because when the book came in...
The dogs.
There were two. What kind of dogs? Licking your face, jumping up on you. How'd they get in the photo? You made sure they got in the photo.
Well, you know, NASA says that, you know, when you take your official picture before you go fly in space, that you can bring your family in.
Right.
Now, my human family was in Virginia, but I had my dogs there in Alago, and I... You know, they don't allow dogs at NASA, so I had to sneak them in through a van, and we came up the back stairs, and we got in there, and I had like about 100 milk bones that they were, you know, eating happily. And then I came out of my orange pumpkin suit. They ran over to me. I told the photographer, I said, start shooting. That's the, you know, kids and baby, you know, dogs and babies, you know, you never know what you're going to do. But when they came over, Jake was in my ear. Scout was looking. And if you look at the picture, all of us are holding hands.
Oh, that is
true.
Two
paws and a hand.
We're
all connected. And that was, when I saw that, I'm like, yeah, that's the shot. That's the shot.
You're a natural, as they used to say in television, the camera loves you. Because you have such a great expression, and you know, the dogs are...
Sheer joy, you know?
Are they still around?
No, they both passed. I had to put both of them down. But we took trips. We actually took a trip up to Columbia Point, where we honored the Columbia crew up in the 14,000-foot mountain, and we walked up there together, and... So we have had a lot of good memories,
You have another dog?
We're getting more.
Oh, you got it.
Sometime soon.
Right. Let's talk about Administrator Bolden, who used to be a regular guest on Science Friday, no longer. I used to always look forward to him because he was a real straight shooter. He would tell us exactly what's going on. Did he have any influence on your career?
He did. I mean, at the point that I was thinking about applying to become an astronaut, I remember I was up at NASA headquarters, and he was walking down the hall. And I said to him, I said, you know, I'm thinking about applying to the astronaut corps. He said, well, you can't get in unless you apply. You need to apply. And so he kind of put the nail in the coffin and convinced me to fly, you know, to apply. But just such an incredible advocate for education and for, you know, helping inspire. You know, if you're walking down the hall and there's a kid there, it'll be another 30 minutes before he gets to the meeting that he was supposed to go to because he's sitting there trying to get this kid inspired and motivated to believe in themselves and do anything they want to. And I appreciate all of his efforts, not just for running the space agency, but for that piece of education.
You're a great storyteller. I mean, you have that talent. I don't know
how
much
you.
Editing takes a book.
I've been listening to you all these years. You know?
Stop.
Like, no, seriously, though. I mean, I can't believe I'm on Science Friday today.
We're so happy to have you on Science Friday. But I will, because you have met famous people I wish I had met. I'm going to go through the book. You're like dropping names all over the place. It's just great because you've actually legitimately met them. And people who were not famous when you met them, like Hidden Figures, Katherine Johnson.
She's my Shiro. She's another Shiro.
Shiro.
You know, in 1989, I started working at NASA Langley, and she retired in 86. And I remember we would go to these meetings, these National Technical Association meetings, and she was the treasurer, and I was a member. But I never knew all the stories about what she had actually done. And when the movie came out, you know, you saw these. I was watching the movie with her. And whenever there was a piece of, you know, footage that something was like spot on, she would smile. And then when something was Hollywoodized, she would like kind of frown or shake her head. That didn't happen, you know.
Right.
So, but just an I saw her about a week ago, and I gave her a copy of Chasing Space, and she was really happy. And you know, the blurb on the back where she was waiting to see, you know, a black man fly in space, which she has seen. And she had a friend who flew in space, too. So that was a big honor for me to give her my NASA-flown pin.
Wow.
Because NASA had never given her the Silver Snoopy that we give to people to keep us safe.
Right.
And so we retroactively gave her the Silver Snoopy, and I took my pin back.
I mean, I'm going to say three things that are in your book. Another great story. I don't want to screw it up. I'll let you do it. And you tie them all together, okay?
Okay.
One is going to be Star Trek, Whoopi Goldberg, and Martin Luther King, Jr.
Whoopi. Okay, I got Lieutenant Uhura.
Okay,
and
let's go there first.
So Nichelle Nichols, who was this incredible person on Star Trek, the first African-American woman on television in the 60s that was in a leadership role. And she was going to quit the show. You know, Gene Roddenberry brought her in and had this great crew, and she was going to quit the show and go back to theater and dance. And she gave her resignation. He said, just think about it over the weekend. Over that weekend, she went to an NAACP meeting in L.A., and this guy told her that her number one fan was right around the corner. So she walks around the corner, and it's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sitting there like a little kid, like looking at his star, you know, his idolized star. And he tells her, he says, Nichelle, you cannot quit this show. because you're doing what I'm trying to do with the civil rights movement right now. And you and Gene and that cast, you know, the first interracial kiss in the 60s.
Yeah.
The first intergalactic kiss also when he kissed the green woman. Captain Kirk kissed the green woman, right? And all this stuff going on when we have all this unrest in the South, the Freedom Riders getting bombed and all these other things going on. And Star Trek on television is breaking all these boundaries.
Mm-hmm. And Whoopi Goldberg tied in. I'll refresh your memory.
Okay.
When she saw that Nichelle Nichols was on Star Trek,
She wanted to be.
She said anybody could
anybody
make
could
it.
Be in it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And so then NASA hired Nichelle Nichols to bring in the first women and minorities. So Sally Ride,
right.
Guy Bluford, you know, Mae Jemison, all these people were kind of recruited through her efforts to inspire people that didn't have, you know, white skin and crew cuts.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Right stuff, folks. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Northern Virginia. Let's go to Alden. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey there.
Ira. Hey, sorry about that. First-time caller, long-time listener. I hope you guys are doing well. I've got a question. How do I spur interest in science and space in my preschool-age son? He's not yet 4.
This is something right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, so you can take in the back of Chasing Space, the Young Readers Edition, we have STEM on the cheap, and we're building rocket racers. We're building rockets where you can actually make them out of very inexpensive materials, and it's very fun activities. If you don't want to buy the book, go to LelandMelvin.com, and we have built out a website that's called STEMography, Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, and Mathematics. And biographies combined. And there are similar experiments on there. But the main thing is to go outside at the night sky and watch the space station coming overhead and knowing that there are 5 people up there, one of which is the first female commander of the International Space Station. And she was my commander when I was there. And now she's going to be the longest running U.S. astronaut, 650 days in space. So tell your children that this woman is up there doing these incredible things, and people from around the world are working together as one civilization, not fighting, not warring, but working together. And so the space station is a good thing to look at, and then just being curious. I mean, there's so much stuff on the internet you can do and teach about science and STEM and space.
And we have Science Friday education site also. It's got all kinds of great stuff and projects in it. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Leland Melvin, who's a great storyteller. And his new book, Chasing Space, An Astronaut's Story of Grit, Grace, and Second Chances. We had astronaut Mike Massimino on the show a while back. We graduated the same high school.
Really?
Actually. We lived about 2 blocks away. We didn't know it.
I heard about a bagel story.
Oh, is that right? And he said one of the things that you can't train for is all the emotions that you experience in space.
True.
What was it like?
You know, people try to tell you before you go to space what you're going to feel. And I told them to shut up. And I don't want to hear your account of it. Right. I wanted to feel it for the first time. You know, Ira, when I got to space, I undid my seatbelt and things were floating around me, and I pushed off with my back and I started floating toward the window. My job at that point was to grab a video camera and film the external tank falling back to the Earth, and that was a witness plate if something had come off and hit one of the wings. But after the tank moved, I saw the Caribbean. I saw the blues of the ocean. I needed new definitions of blue to describe the colors, the number of hues that I could see with my eyes, and azure, indigo, cerulean, I mean, turquoise, that's all I had in my vocabulary. But it was just all these shades. And thinking of the coral reefs that were down there, that were brimming with life, these incubators of life in these oceans. And to think what's happening to our oceans with, climate change and all these other things, it just makes you want to come back and do more. You get this orbital perspective, this shift cognitively that, you know.
Do you think kids are the answer, working with kids?
It's inspiring them. It's allowing them to dream so that they can have a dream of a future that's inclusive and free of all these isms and things. And it starts with play. I mean, if you're in school right now, you're kind of teaching, getting taught to the test, to take a test, which is sometimes not attached to building and creating and exploring. And so if we can't get that in school, maybe we need to get that at home or through community centers or Boys and Girls Clubs, or, you know, there are other ways to get that. Like I built a bread truck with my dad.
Yeah.
And he drove this Merida bread truck into our driveway. And I said, okay, he's a school teacher. He's a musician. Now he's a bread truck driver. And he said, no, this is our camper. And over that summer, we repurposed that bread truck into bunk beds that flipped down. That's mechanical engineering. We plumbed a propane tank into a Coleman stove, chemical engineering, and we rewired the whole van, electrical engineering. I was becoming an engineer in sixth grade, building a bread truck camper.
So you're an inspiration. I mean, you are sort of a mentor for kids.
We all are. We all are.
Think we all are?
We all are. It's just, are we good ones or bad ones? We all have an opportunity to light a child's curiosity by just showing them something. And that light can go so far, and just believing in them and giving them an opportunity. I think we sometimes, you know, we have Angela Duckworth and Carol Dweck. We have a fixed mindset where we focus down instead of letting kids know that they can be a mathematician and a jock or and a whatever it is, and just let their minds grow.
Did you say that there's a kids' edition of this book?
Yeah.
Well, what is it? How do we get a hold of it?
So it's Chasing Space, the Young Readers Edition, and it's for middle grade students, so maybe sixth grade through ninth grade. And it's got the experiments in the back. It's you can get it at any of your booksellers that you go to, but it's a lot of fun.
It's a great book, Leland. Leland Melvin, author of Chasing Space, an astronaut's story of grit, grace, and second chances. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ira.
It was great having you on here. Let's tell our listeners that on our website at sciencefriday.com/astronaut, they can read an excerpt from your book on there. That's great. One last thing before we go. It's almost time for Cephalopod Week, and Science Friday is teaming up with Atlas Obscura for a series of cephalo parties in New York, L.A., Chicago, and San Francisco. You got to be there. For more info, buy tickets, go to sciencefriday.com/movie night. That's sciencefriday.com/movie night, Cephalopod Week. Be there or be square, as we used to say generations ago. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great holiday weekend. Have a safe one. I'm Ira Flatow. We'll see you next week.